Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off-Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for people who feel disconnected from church. On today's Off-Grid Christianity is an author who has an interest in social justice. But what does he mean by social justice? And why has he a passion for, in his words, the unheard voice? Why does he call himself a ragamuffin? It gives me great pleasure to welcome to today's Off-Grid Christianity podcast, Andy Smithyman. Andy, thank you so much for joining us today. And no doubt we will find out all those answers in the next hour.
But if I'm intrigued as well.
Yeah, me too. So if you're ready then, before we find out what a ragamuffin is, I have five almost sensible questions so we can get a better picture of who you are. So if you're ready, good sir, fingers on the buzzers, no conferring. If you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask them questions, who would it be?
Da, da, da. It's a tough one, isn't it? This is so tough. At this moment in time, it would be Rich Mullins.
Okay, because?
I mean, sadly, he's passed away now, but I really connected to his vulnerability and his willingness to own contradictions.
Yes.
And in a world he was in, he was a Christian musician, in a world that was getting very slick and professional, it was just so beautifully amateurish. You know,
yeah.
The way he dressed, some of the sounds, some of the songs, it was beautiful. And his relationship with Brennan Manning, bringing in that kind of element of grace and mercy, just disrupted that very slick idea of what faith is. And yeah, I would love to spend some time just chatting to that guy.
Yeah. I could say that I have, but I'm really fine.
Very jealous.
Maybe I'll talk about it some other time. But yes, I had the privilege of interviewing him live on stage in between tracks at a Crossroads Festival way back.
And what was that like?
He was just an incredibly humble guy, and he had his Cimbalom to play, and there's two tracks that I absolutely adored him playing. One was called Creed, and I can't remember what the other one was. And basically, he'd play a couple of tracks with him and just his guitarist, and everybody was sitting like cross-legged in this marquee, and we then talk about whatever. And then I said, well, you know, we're short of time now, because you play another track. And he said, what would you like? I said, well, I'd love to hear Creed and the other one. He said, well, you can only have one. What do you want? I went, ooh, Creed then, please. You know, he was brilliant. He was, because sometimes you think, oh, would an artist be prepared to spend an hour on stage with me?
Yeah.
Talking to them and playing music. But it was just such a chilled place. And he'd already done a major set anyway somewhere else. So, you know, to take part in that, it was phenomenal. Yeah.
That's, the Elder the Jesus album, the one he was working on when he died. So you got the demo tracks. Beautiful. There's a precious track on there called Heaven in His Eyes, which is just like the way he was able to capture essence of faith and put it into visual examples was amazing. That's a great track.
Yeah. And the way he wrote his lyrics as well. A great lyricist. Good answer, thank you. Question number two. Who is your favourite biblical character or favourite biblical story or favourite parable?
Yeah, so this, I think the story that's living with me now for many years is it's in John's Gospel. It's a guy who's waiting at the pool to get healed.
Oh, yeah. Bethsaida, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think.
And the reason why connect to that is it reminds me of a play that was written some years back. There's a loose adaptation of that, and it's telling the story of a guy who's suffering from melancholy, depression, and goes to a pool to get healed. And I'm going to use a ton of creative license on this to prove my point. But he goes to the pool, watching the waters. So when the waters disturb, that's when the divine presence is there to get healed. And the waters ripple. He heads down and an angel stands in front of him and says, step back, this time's not for you. So he goes back and, you know, maybe he's thinking about he needs to be a better person or he needs to prove his desire to be healed. And then the waters ripple again. He heads down, step back, this time's not for you. And eventually the guy freaks out at the angel and asks him, why aren't you letting me get to the pool? And the angel responds with this. It says, without your wounds, where would your power be? It is your melancholy that makes your low voice tremble into the hearts of men and women. The very angels themselves cannot persuade the wretched and blundering children on earth, as can one human being broken on the wheels of living. In love service, only wounded soldiers can serve. And that story lives with me because it disturbs that story, that idea of what we think perfection is and what I think perfection is. I don't understand why sometimes our tears don't get dried up when we want them to. I don't understand why sometimes questions don't get answered, or the limp that we walk with doesn't go away, or the scars don't disappear. But what I have observed is that sometimes those scars, sometimes those tears and questions frame our words in a way that reaches the heart of a human life in a way that no polished articulation could be, that vulnerability, that brokenness. And that's a mystery, and it's a beautiful mystery, and it's a painful mystery. And it disturbs me in a good way because it moves away from a very individualistic thing and connects the journey that I'm on, all the good and the bad and the joy and the sorrow, with fellow pilgrims. And I don't know whether the scars will always be healed, but I do know there's a power in those scars, and yes, there's a power in our limp.
Yes.
There's a power in our questions unanswered.
Yes.
That maybe we find out one day what that all means, you know?
Isn't it so? We could talk about this for ages because I don't know if you're aware, but my wife, like yourself, is a cancer survivor.
Right.
And no doubt you'll talk about that, allude to it later on. But I think that also is the definition for me is the difference between sympathy and empathy.
Yeah.
You can walk along with someone and say, oh, no, I'm really sorry to hear that, blah, blah, blah. But you can then, for empathy, you can walk along with someone and say, I'm really sorry to hear that. I've been through that too. And
yeah,
that's often the barrier that is then taken away, so the person will then want to know more.
Absolutely. The tone changes. The words change. The heart. Yeah, it's a precious thing. It's one of those questions of our faith that I don't think it's a lingering question.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense why brokenness is so powerful. But it's important. Brokenness is such a, I think brokenness is such a vital element of our faith.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm.
Wow.
There you go.
Yeah. And we've only done two questions, and we could carry on about that, about being broken.
It's
something that I've been told many a time. You know, you have to be broken in order to be free. Question number three.
Yes.
If you were prime minister for the day, well, this could be interesting. We might have another. We might have another one in the next couple of hours. If you were prime minister for the day and could change any law or impose a new law, what would it be, young Andy?
Ooh, so a light-hearted one would be hold music. I absolutely hate hold music.
Explain to people what hold music is, please.
Oh, it's just like, it seems to be more post-COVID. It's the way you're on the phone waiting for somebody to answer this call center, and you've just got this horrendous music that keeps looping. But genuinely, I wouldn't want to be prime minister. But if it was in that space, I would love to play around with what an alternative moral economy looks like. So I'm kind of being like a Victor Meldrew kind of old geezer moany kind of guy now, but I'm really concerned with how corporate and business are. They've always shaped society. They've always contributed to how society frames itself. But it feels like now there's an element of governmental sort of operations. If you look at, like, they involved in our communication, how we communicate to one to another, it's creeping into basic core utilities and fundamental pillars of society and stuff like that. And it's a broad brushstroke, but it's like corporates, if they're owned by shareholders, their ultimate aim is the benefit of the shareholder. Could argue that most times that is a narrative of profit, and often shareholders can be these faceless entities. So even if you got all this lovely corporate social responsibility goals and nice little sidelines, underpinning everything is this narrative of profit.
Yes.
And then if you think about their role in society now, in some of these fundamental pillars, that's a little bit scary. And so I'd love to play around with what's an alternative to that. And there's loads of examples out there now, which I'm aware of, but it would be great to go full on. And what gives me hope is history. There's a cool example of this in history. I hate the term, but Quaker capitalism.
Okay.
Is, you can pull it apart now, just like how whatever cool stuff is happening now, 20, 30 years time, there's going to be a generation that looks at it and pulls it apart because of what we've learned during that time. But Quakers, I love their history because they were persecuted in the early years. They were persecuted partly because of their connection to the English Civil War. And so they were barred from ways of operating in society. And so they went underground, and so they developed ways of sharing money. They developed ways of developing businesses and communication and stuff like that. And they built these principles to live by, these moral and ethical principles. Flash forward to the early days of the Industrial Revolution, and it makes sense why the Quakers were so integral into those early framing days. Because they had those structures already in place underground, so they just stuck their head above the parapet type thing. And so if you look at the early days of banks and businesses, yes, they were there to make profit, but underpinning it all was their narrative was around how does this contribute to society? That's why they were so concerned about housing and education in the locations they were building. And they had this lovely accountability they had with each other because that was their principles that they were living by. And yes, you look at how they approached it and you can critique it now, but at the time it was revolutionary. And you just think, I liked that daring approach to kind of rip up the rule book and to think, how can you make profit, but actually underpinning everything is this is about the betterment of society first?
I think what he's trying to say here, because first of all, when you said Quaker capitalism, I was thinking, oh, we buy everything in porridge, but you weren't saying that at all. I suppose the biggest example would be Bourneville, as in Cadbury's.
Yeah.
Because they were Quakers. And they must be spinning in their graves because one of the worst takeover bids in modern history, as far as the UK is concerned, is how Kraft took over Cadbury's. And there's been a big knock-on effect in Bristol on that. Don't get me going on that one. So, yes, interesting. Interesting. You're a very intelligent young man, sir, and no doubt we'll find out more about...
Young man.
Oh, oh, young man. So we'll find out more about that later on. Thank you. Quaker capitalism. I'm going to have to study up on that. Question four. Outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out?
It wasn't a day out. It was a week trip. It was... enjoyable? I don't know if I would term it enjoyable, but it was one of the most life-changing experiences I had, which was I went up to the Isle of Lewis years ago. Isle of Lewis is you kind of go up to the top of Scotland, turn mm-hmm. left, go over some crazy wild water, and then you go to a crazy and wild island. And it was a time when I was doing a lot of research into revival, collecting memorabilia, doing loads of interviews. And the Isle of Lewis had a revival storyline years back. Mm-hmm. And there was people on the island who had lived through that who were still alive on their kind of final days, really. And so I wanted to go up and interview. And I stepped foot on that island as a really arrogant, know-it-all jerk. At that period of time in my life, I knew a lot about what I thought I knew a lot about revival. At the Isle of Lewis, I'd read all the stories.
Yeah.
I'd listened to the sermons from a famous preacher who was associated with that. Got all the details of the two old ladies and the postman linked to that storyline. And my intention was, I'm going to get some interviews, back up some of my theories of what this revival was about, and then write something about it. But I left the island beautifully disturbed and broken, because I met precious pilgrims of our faith. And best way I can describe it is very quickly, I was listening to stories I'd never heard before. And I was listening to stories that their stories had been co-opted by other people who had got famous over. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't understand why they weren't screaming from the rooftop saying, I want my name in the history books. I want my story in the history book. And I was so integral into this thing. Why aren't I? I couldn't understand why they weren't interested.
Yeah.
And to paraphrase their responses, it was that they weren't interested in any sort of praise from humanity. Their only interest was that one day they would be standing before their great love and they hear the words, well done, good and faithful servant. And to create a visual example of that, the people I was interviewing, they looked normal. They were mundane. They wouldn't be the type of people you would put on a stage and create a heroic tale about.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet when you heard their stories, it kind of brought you closer to them into an embrace. And when they embraced you, that's when you felt the splinters in their palms of their hands. And it was the splinters of them gripping that old rugged cross, that cross of what does it mean to love? And their lives were about outliving that question, what does it mean to love? Love your God and to love your neighbor. And it was... There's a philosopher called Simon Critchley who talks about the infinite demand of love. And I love that that description, because love is infinite. Love has this demand that continually compels you to go deeper and deeper into that storyline. And that's what they were doing. They were responding to that demand. And I heard stories I'd never heard before, and beautifully mundane, everyday stories of love. And I left that island realizing that my perception of what revival is, with this book ended, it started here, ends here. Yeah. And it's about this heroic figure and all like that. It can change my perspective of what this storyline really is. And this storyline, yes, has these wonderful firework moments, but behind all that is this deep, deep, precious narrative of everyday love. And that radically changed how I then started researching revival and how I've tried to outlive that from now on.
I say to everybody who I'm contacting first time, including yourself, good sir, that the interview could just go off completely off grid as well. And so we're halfway through the interview. We've only done four questions. I want to take this off grid now, if that's all right, because there'll be plenty of people listening today saying, yeah, I think I've heard of the Lewis Revival. I think I've heard of it. And you've mentioned quite a few times about these wonderful stories that you've heard.
Yeah.
So before we do eventually find out who you really are and why you're an author, let's just spend some time, if that's right, on this. Tell us a couple of stories about the Lewis Revival, please.
The Lewis Revival is it's an odd revival because it has some real dramatic moments of lights appearing in the sky and on the ground and stuff like that. And you've got the storylines of sermons being preached and people rushing to the altar and stuff like that. But behind that, you've got individuals who are taking care of their neighbours. You've got individuals who are thinking about education and healthcare in different ways. And the best way I can describe it, if we kind of pivot away from the Lewis Revival, because I think a really good one to look at is something like the Methodist Revival, like John Wesley, uh-huh, and stuff like that, and George Whitfield. You've got these really famous storylines of a preacher standing on a hilltop praying and preaching, and people rushing to the sort of makeshift altar to get saved and stuff. But you tear back into that, and you've got the sermons were, yes, about salvation, but it was not only about spiritual salvation. It was about salvation of life. And so it was about sermons about how do you protest peacefully in a time when there was a lot of injustice taking place, particularly around taxation and stuff, and slave trade. And then you've got... it is like a controversial one about tithing. Interestingly, a lot of these sermons were not about tithing to the church, but tithing to the society. And so it was about paying for a local doctor. It was about paying for local teachers and stuff like that. And you could go on and on, you know. And yes, it was about the famous Wesley and Whitfield and stuff like that. But you had a bunch of people going up and down this country praying and preaching that type of message. And you could argue that, yes, if you bookend the Methodist Revival with a start date and an end date, which is usually around church growth as in people going
and
to the church.
In the year we're talking about roughly?
It's a weird time because John Wesley, you took like the 18th century, mm-hmm, right?
1700s, yeah.
Yes, yeah, so 1700s, and you've got this element of a lot of people. The Methodist Church is growing, and then as it started to decline, you could say that's when the revival started to finish. But if you approach it from the type of what their message was. At the time of decline, when we're saying that the revival finished, you've got something really interesting happening in society, because that message is creeping into business, is creeping into education, it's creeping into all these different pillars of society. They're starting to frame how laws are being set up, how businesses are restructuring themselves, how teachers are articulating our education principles in different ways. Mm. And so you've got this wonderful kaleidoscope of activity that's shaping society in a way that you could say is this Methodist revolution instead of a revival. And so in a typical church narrative where we're saying this revival finished, actually it didn't. There's this amazing activity taking place, but it's not taking place in the church anymore. It's taking place in society. It's taking place in business and education. So why aren't we talking about that? Why aren't we resourcing that? Why aren't we praising those storylines? And why that's important is that I passionately believe that the world is created through stories. In the sense of stories are really important. Stories shape how we view the world, how we view ourselves, and how we view one another, and how we view our hopes and desires. And so if we're only telling storylines that revival is church growth, revival is a preacher up the front, and revival is about all these big dramatic things, this is a move of God. When we're praying for that to happen again, we could be looking in the wrong place. We could be looking over to, we want this heroic figure. We want all this church growth. And we're looking over there and we're thinking, why aren't our prayers being answered? And yet, if you just turn your head a fraction and start listening to alternative storylines of what does it mean to love, and you look to the mundane and the everyday, you look to the storylines of how is education changing? How are people shifting, bringing principles and values and ethics into society? You possibly might just see that there's a move of God taking place, but in an alternative narrative.
I'm going to leave the last question to the very end, all right? Your most embarrassing moment, because I think we could carry on this. Because you... and hopefully you can allude as well about you being an author. You've already talked, given an example of your book, Revival Symphony book. But I said right at the very beginning that you were into social justice and that you were also a ragamuffin. So explain what that means, especially in the context of what you've just been saying regarding, you know, revival isn't just about church growth. It's the knock-on effect to society, please.
So a ragamuffin, I use the word ragamuffin in the sense of vulnerability, of brokenness, of contradictions. And I've always pictured that term ragamuffin as, for me, it captures this idea of a journey. Mm-hmm. Of a pilgrim journey, of a journey where a pilgrim for me is, you know, like you can, if you're going on a journey, you have a map and you got this destination, you're on this pilgrimage, you've got this destination you're heading to. But it's weird because it's the journey, it's your experiences, It's the trials, it's the laughs, it's the people you meet along the way that makes the ending make sense when you reach it and you place your stone on that altar and you make your prayer. It's the journey that has crafted the words that you articulate, not the map. Mm-hmm. And so I hold on to that. That's how I make sense of what does it mean to be a follower of Christ for me. It's learning to be in the moment. It's learning to appreciate the journey and understand that there's not going to be all the answers, but one day, maybe when I place that pebble on the altar, I'm going to understand what that journey is. So that's what the ragamuffin for me means. As for revival, what was your question on the revival?
Very good. I can't remember. Trying to dig into that. But I'm going to link this forward, okay? And I'm not going to edit it out either. but I'm going to link this forward, actually, because you've just answered very well, I think, why we can understand now why, especially over the map and the stone, I really get that. And it's the words that go around. It's the people you meet.
Yeah.
I'd love to know more about you being an author, but why you got into writing and, you know, what you were doing before that, so you can get a better picture of you, if that's all right, as to what really stokes your fire. So tell us a bit more about who you were and how you got into authoring, if that's the right word.
So writing, I was a weird kid. I was a preacher's kid.
All right, okay.
And
which denomination?
So my mum and dad were a bit of rebellious. They kind of my dad was heavily influenced by the healing evangelists. There was this crazy period of time called the Voice of Healing movement in the States and the UK. We had all these different healing evangelists, and there was a lot of contradictions and incompleteness with all that.
Mm.
Dad was heavily influenced by that. And so he did that. And so I was in this kind of strange world. I was the only kid. And I struggled with communication. And so I found that the best way I could communicate was with writing. Mm-hmm. So I did that. I was this kind of loner kid, and so I used to just enjoy surrounding myself with books and creating these fantasy stories. And it was a way of managing those school years that were quite tough. So that's always been with me. They're kind of those internal storylines.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then, so, and I always kind of got raised up with revival storylines from my dad, my mum and dad, but also my grandmother. My grandmother was a very old time Pentecostal lady. so she lived with the Trinity of what old time Pentecostal is, which is scripture, prayer, and knitting. Really, that was her kind of thing. And so I remember my early childhood stories were, you know, there's one character, I was very, going back to your first question about who do you like around the table.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a healing evangelist called A.A. Allen, who, very controversial character in the mid 21st century, but my dad was loved that character. He was he did some really interesting crusades. Well, you can't, that's a horrible word now.
No, I know what you mean though. Yeah,
but tours around the country in a time, particularly in the States, in a time of segregation.
Yeah,
he refused segregation in his tent crusade, tent meetings, and his worship leader was black. And in the time of early TV, that's a powerful statement. He was evangelist who would stay and do the course. So he would sit in the tent and pray for as many people as he could, even when the meeting finished. I collected a ton of video clips, particularly from his son, of his meetings and some crazy miracles that took place. And he died a controversial death, depending on the type of narrative you focus on. But I remember, so I was raised in that kind of culture. These were my childhood stories. And my mom would tell me those tales. My grandmother would. There was a connection to George Jeffreys, which is a famous preacher earlier on that influenced my family. And so that's the sort of like revival thing kind of just rubbed off. And then eventually I started delving into that. And then as I started doing, adventured into kind of work days, I used to give my summer holidays over to just doing that in different ways. So I used to write to varied ministries and say, I'll give my summer holidays to work there. So I connected to some really interesting individuals. And then that led me into social justice work, really, because I started to see revival in a different way, started to move away from church-centric, heroic-centric narratives, and started to see the hidden narratives that were taking place, the stories that either got edited out of our books that we pick up from Amazon and Christian bookshops because they're not dramatic and exciting, or that their stories don't fit into our nice, neat little box.
Yes, yes.
And that got me into looking elsewhere, and then that got me into working alongside and other individuals and trying to figure out a way of working that out on a daily life. So eventually I did kind of like half my week writing and half my week working with different charities and organizations, and then rebalance that a bit, and then try to outwork it in how I write now and what I try and put my energy to.
Gotcha. Well, that makes more and more sense, because on your website, I'm going to use the word allude again because it's a good word. You allude to co-developing a charity which got £57 million to distribute with a 6% operating budget. And that is like, whoa. So for every pound you give 94p away for the charity. That is pretty darn good going.
Yeah, but the thing is with bios is I...
You made it up. Right, okay. Well,
again, just being brutally honest with the industry, you know, that... So pre-cancer, I was debating how to play around with my website. So I haven't done anything on my website for a bit now. Because the industry I was part of, particularly around the writing thing and then doing the thing about ghostwriting, is you kind of, you big yourself up.
Yeah, I get that.
And you play the game. And that bio is definitely that. Yes, I was involved with what you just articulated there, but there's a bunch of people, and it sounds great, and it did some amazing stuff, and there's also some faults with that as well, but it was such a precious time working on that, and when I have enough energy, I want to play around with how do you write a bio that is just beautifully honest and doesn't play the game. Doesn't play the game about bigging you up so it impresses somebody to want you to do a job.
Exactly. No, I get that.
You get what I mean?
You know, I do get that because, you know, at the end of the day, if you're going for a job, you want to impress the most important person who's going to interview you. So you have to give all these great things that you've done.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, if I have to go for another job, well, you know, going around the country following a certain football team, I don't think that'd go down too well, really.
But you see, you know, like that bio, it's like, why did I have to mention the money? You know,
yeah, why did you? Well, there you go. Then, why did you?
There was a reason. Yeah, there was a reason. It was intentional, and it sucks. Absolutely sucks. And it shows, it reveals, particularly when I wrote it, it reveals the, in order, pardon me, I'm just going to cough him. I'm back.
Good muting.
It reveals alternative motives. And it's, you know, going to the writing thing, it's the reason why I wanted to play around with an alternative way of doing publishing. Because I wanted to get back to an authentic approach of what does it mean to be a writer? What does it mean to, so for example, if I used to do book tours, so I'd done a book, you go around, do your little book tour. The typical thing would be that I would turn up to an event and you talk about the topic of the book and all that kind of stuff. But ultimately, what I was there for was I'm pitching my book to this audience. Yeah. So they, that's my ultimate motive. Maybe, probably not for most authors, but for me, that was my ultimate, because it was all about sales.
Yes.
The more sales I got, the more credit I would get and da da da, da, you know. And then when you're doing the book signing, it would be like 20 seconds interaction, you're on to the next person. That sucks. Absolutely sucks. And the same with the way the book was created. You know, it's always about mass sales. So everywhere I would go, somebody asks me about, what do you do? Oh, I'm a writer. Here's my book. You know, I'm talking about my book. Because it's all about trying to get this thing out, because it's all about mass distribution. And so the idea of playing around with setting up a publishing house was, can I create something? And it's nothing new, because loads of other people are doing it as well. But can I create a way of operating where you create a book that reflects the nature of what you write in? So the way you pull it together. Mm-hmm. So it's not a template. Can you ethically create that book in all the material and how you put it together? And then with the Paradox book, which was, I wrote a book and I wanted to experiment on myself first to see if the model worked. Could I do a book tour that's not about the book, selling the book? And so I had this crazy idea for a year, which was dinner party. So it was, I would just go around people's homes and somebody would just invite me and you'd be around a dinner table, 6-10 people. And the only thing that the only onus on the person was that they'd have to supply the drinks or the snacks. And I would go there and we'd talk about the themes in the book. There'd be a Q&A and that's it.
And did it work?
It was really hard work. It worked in some cases. Depends on terms of success. So if I had to travel up north, because I'm a kind of like a southern softie, if I had to travel up north, if cost effective return on investment was hard, I had to figure out creative ways of doing that, in the sense of because maybe 2-3 if 6 people around the dining room table and they bought the book, that's 6 books.
Yeah.
Doesn't really cover everything of staying up there or the transport. And so I had to figure out creative ways of tagging on other stuff. But it did work. because what I got from it was, it was kind of like an adaptation of like how Keith Green did it. If like this guy who kind of did an alternative way of doing concerts and creating a database away from the main industry. So I got an interaction with readers in a completely different dynamic than how I did in the past. The conversations we'd have post that over email and phone was deep. And I've got a relationship with some of those readers now that I never had before. And I know that whatever else I'm doing, they're there. And so there's a community there. And it also showed me that, yes, you can create a book in a different model. That's not about mass distribution. That is kind of like a limited run. Mm. It costs a little bit more, but actually there's something about craftsmanship that I adore and people connect to. It's just like, again, it's just hacking away at, can you find alternative ways of operating that reflect the values that you live by, that sometimes go against the current tide of thinking, and values the beauty of art. Yeah.
No, I hear that. It's thinking outside the proverbial box, isn't it? I'm looking at alternative ways of doing it, and it can be done. And every so often we hear people who do it. So how many books have you written, by the way?
Under my own name is 3. So 2 non-fiction, which are kind of like revival themed. Mm-hmm. And then here's a good little rabbit hole to go down. So I wanted to write, the third one's called Paradox. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to write about revival, but not use the term revival, and not write to a Christian audience. And so I eventually ended up writing a fiction story that's a reimagination of Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol. And the reason why I did that was that during the, like, because I adore Charles Dickens. It's the reason why, so my publishing house is called Boz, and it's a hat tip to when Dickens was kind of learning his craft, he wrote under the name Boz.
Oh, did he? Okay.
So it's a little hat tip.
Yeah, that's a good Dickens. One, though.
But the time of Dickens, where we talk about Dickensian landscape, you know, it's a good example of social injustice. There's so much naffness taking place there. Dickens is a social commentator, and so a lot of his stories carry elements of truth and reality, and he just adapts them. He describes himself as, he used to pound the streets. And I love that. So through observation, he crafted these stories. And yes, there's this rough Dickensian element during that time, but there's this beautiful expression of, how do you deal with this? And Dickens best describes it through the themes of ignorance and selfish want. So he often links back to those themes, sometimes very blatantly, like, for example, in the Christmas Carol, the two children that emerge are ignorance and selfish want. And then, and sometimes in some of his books, it's just like a little hat tip, a little nod to those themes. But he kind of, the way I read it is, he describes that Dickensian time as, these are issues that relate to ignorance and selfish want. But he also refers to the response to that, the positive response to an alternative way of dealing with that, is about, how do you deal with ignorance and how do you deal with selfish want? And when you look at that, that was my hook into revival, because when you tear back it all, you think, what does it mean not to be ignorant? What does it mean to pop your self-centered bubble to look at the other, the stranger, the person next to you. What does it mean to live a life that is not about selfish want? And for me, that is the fundamental things of what does it mean to love? Going back to the very start of the, of our interview, mate, it's the storyline of love.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we don't have many revival storylines during the Dickensian period. We don't talk about it as moves of God. And yet when you move our lens, move the lens away from revival is always about big dramatic moments, it's always about church growth, it's always about some dramatic preaching. Move the lens away from that and move the lens on what is revival all about ultimately. It's about love. It's about what does it mean to love God? What does it mean to love one another? What does it mean, this sacrificial, deep narrative of love? Move that, the whole Dickensian storyline, through a Christian lens, completely changes. And you see some very beautiful expressions of a move of God that makes me... I'm deeply passionate about... deeply passionate that we've got to start telling stories of mundane, of the beautiful mundane. We've got to start valuing what does it mean to live out our faith. And we might not ever get to a platform. We might not ever get our names written in some history books, yeah, or ever get praised. But what we're doing in our home, what we're doing in our schools, what we're doing in our business, what we're doing with baking a cake for our neighbor, dropping a food parcel off, reconfiguring our daily lives so we can spend more time with our kids, all this kind of stuff is all part of this storyline of love. And that drives me. That's what it means for the nameless. That's what it means by the hidden narratives. And I would love to one day find a way that we can, in one side, drop this revival term. It carries so much baggage. And we just start redefining that storyline and repositioning it into this continual storyline of what does it mean to love? So, yeah, that's a little bit of a tangent, but that's... So three books, mate.
And, some ghostwriting.
I did a bit of ghostwriting and then I write some other little things. That's what I've done so far.
Wow. Well, I said at the very beginning we'd go off on a tangent and and then some, you know. And
yeah, so sorry.
No, it's brilliant because you're really building up a picture about Charles Dickens and I get that. And I think of Oliver Twist and that book, that narrative changed people's perceptions. Now, a bit like Kathy Come Home in the 1960s, the play for today.
Yeah.
Look what that did. You know, the following day, everybody in government were talking about it and they realised they had to sort out benefits and everything else. So, you know, maybe your book Paradox will do something similar in Christian circles to realise it is about love, you know.
But just thinking of stories, mate, you're just thinking of people who are listening to your podcast.
Yeah.
And just... it's stories are beautiful. They're magical, mystical things. And the
that
stories
was a super
that
track,
we hold
track there, you were just singing there. Magical, mystical. I was just off of that.
But they're precious. The stories that we hold ourselves, you know, our own stories. And so many times it's easy to devalue our own story because they're not the dramatic and the heroic. And yet, a story can. There's a term called critical yeast, which I love, which is the idea that yeast is this very small little thing, and yet, in the right conditions, it can transform so much. And this is going back to the Isle of Lewis story, really, which is the thing that really disturbed me beautifully because it exposed so many of my flaws, is that the stories that we hold, our own stories, sometimes they are like yeast, where they reside, they impact other individuals. And yet we might never see the influence our own story has had on somebody else, because we might die before that interaction has really taken place.
And Livingstone comes to mind.
Exactly.
Was it about 5 or 6 people became Christians when he was over there in Africa through his his mission work? And it was only after he died that the dam was burst.
And you take that, and it's this precious challenge of, we might think that we haven't done anything marvelous or magical, and we might not have reached hundreds and thousands, and all we've done is been this diligent teacher at school. Mm-hmm. And yet, one day, in my kind of creative writing kind of imaginary world, it's like, one day maybe we will see all that. One day, you know, in that great day.
Yeah.
But it's living with this thing that even if we don't see the evidence of it, our story is beautifully precious, and it is this yeast that is feeding into society, feeding into our neighbours and our children and our work colleagues, and it will cause an interaction. And sometimes we will see that evidence, sometimes we won't. Doesn't matter, as long as we're living out that story of love.
Wow. Well, time is beating us here. We haven't done question 5. I don't think I'm going to do question 5. I'm going to leave it. You're the first person.
Wow.
Because you said so many amazing things. And for those that are listening today who would consider themselves off-grid or really, as I use the word, disillusioned with church at the moment, and so thank you for listening to these podcasts. I hope it's encouraging you. What would you like to say to people who've been moved by what you've been saying? What would you like to say to them?
That's a good question. So I would, my email and communication is always open. I love hearing stories. I love communicating with people. And so that's always there.
Well, you need to give a plug for a start.
The plug is email me, which is andy@andysmitherman.com. andysmitherman.com. But for me, you are heroes. I think you often ask about heroes, don't you?
We got yours coming up. We will do that.
You are heroes of the faith. You really are. Because heroes is not about how we kind of try and box it and try and look at just the dynamic and charismatic. Yeah. And so I'm passionate about redefining that hero narrative. And so there's value in what you're doing. And yes, stories may not make sense, but there's this really, I don't know if I'll do it justice, but there's this old sort of mystic, St. John of the Cross, that talks about the dark night of the soul. Mm. Where we typically, I used to gain this horrible broad brushstroke of charismatic faith, it's definitely a bias on charismatic faith here, but where we're always on this onward trajectory, we're always going up, 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 getting better, more prosperous, da, 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 up, 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 up. And if you're not going up, 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 then there's something wrong with you. But the dark night of the soul is talking about going down. Is going into moments where everything doesn't make sense, where it is the dark night of the soul, where you've got loads of questions. It's the moments where you're screaming at the top of your voice, blood vessels pulsing, and having a go at God or having a go at yourself, because it's not the narrative of going up, 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 up. And people around will look at that moment and think that if you on a Christian narrative, you're backsliding or you're losing your faith and stuff like that. St. John of the Cross talks about that actually this is the deepest part of our faith, because that's when you strip away all the superficial stuff, all the identity, all the lingo, all the spin, and you're there with God in the muckiness and the uncertainty and the mystery and the unanswered questions of life. And that's the rawness of our faith. And in that moment of the dark night of the soul, eventually you start going up. And your lens has changed, your articulation and your life has changed. And you go up for a bit, and then you hit another issue. Yeah. And you because you then sort of start questioning something else. And so embrace that cycle. That's what I would say. It's a long, winding answer, but it's like embrace
the cycle.
Yeah.
Yeah, embrace that. Well, that's a great, could be a nice title for a forthcoming book that then became a fantastic movie.
Yeah, I'm right. I'm slowly crafting, you know, we alluded to it, but the cancer thing.
Yeah.
Radically changed my life, and just starting to pen.
And we've run out of time really to talk about the cancer thing, but I take it you're doing all right over that now, are you?
Yeah, I'm doing all right. As with all storylines of cancer, there's a brokenness and mystery with that.
Yeah.
But working through it.
Well, maybe we can talk about that some other time. Andy, look, time has beaten us. I am leaving question five out, your most embarrassing moment. You can tell me that afterwards over a cup of coffee. but this has been a BCSC production. And if you want to get hold of us, you can at OGC, which funnily enough stands for Off Grid Christianity, OGC@accessradio.biz, and biz is spelled B-I-Z. If you've been particularly challenged by what Andy said and you want to get hold of him, his email address again is
andy@andysmithyman.com. It's andysmithyman.com.
And if you want to read his bio and see, oh, look, he put that, I don't understand, oh, whatever, your website address is, sir?
andysmithyman.com.
Well, there you go. It couldn't be easier, could it? Andy, it's been amazing to hear from you. You've certainly said things in a loving way as well. I'm going to have to buy one of your books now.
Martin, thanks so much, mate. I've really enjoyed this.
Brilliant. Speak to you again. Cheers. God bless.
Yeah. Thanks, mate.